Welcome to the Supply Chain Talks podcast. My name is Sophie van den Enk, and in season two of this podcast, I will dive into the world of sustainable container supply chains. As decision makers, cargo owners, and freight forwarders play a key role in boosting sustainability in the logistics chain. But how do you build a CO2 neutral and at the same time resilient supply chain? And what are the possibilities and standout examples that exist today? Reduce, replace, rethink is a concept that can be used as a strategy to decarbonize your supply chain. And each episode, I will dive into one of these three concepts with container industry experts. This episode, we're talking about replace, and we'll dive into sustainable container shipping, replacing fossil fuels with renewable fuels. The fuel switch, obviously. It is vital that the shipping industry makes this switch to renewable fuels to achieve net zero emissions by 2050, and what are the options for these huge container vessels that facilitate international trade, and how challenging is the fuel switch? What role can cargo owners play? Joining me to find these answers are Naomi van den Berg, the Port of Rotterdam Authority. That's where you work. Good to have
good
you
morning.
Here, Naomi.
Yeah. Thank you.
And Ilyas Mohammed from Carrier Hapag Lloyd. Really good to have both of you here to talk about this super important topic, because if you guys can manage to really make a change, we do it on a huge scale. So that's exciting. Ilyas, to start with you, can you maybe introduce yourself? You're originally from Pakistan and now you work at Hapag Lloyd. Why do you feel passionate about this topic and what do you do there?
Yeah, good morning and thanks for inviting me to this podcast. So I'm working as a head of green fuels at Hapag Lloyd. And the passion basically comes from the work which we are doing is basically creating an impact in terms of reducing the greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in Pakistan, and my hometown is located in between two largest rivers in Pakistan. And we as a community have seen the firsthand effects of climate change in terms of floodings. And this year we hear that in Himalayas there was less snowfall. So there is a likelihood that there will be droughts in the summer of this year, 2024.
Wow.
And while working at Hapag Lloyd, I see that I can create this impact while reducing our, as a company, we can by switching from fossil fuels to renewable fuels, we can reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and create an impact in reducing the global warming and climate change.
Wow, yeah. So because of your background, you really understand in a very real way the effects of climate change, and that makes you want to make a change.
And also, I'm coming with the engineering background, so I previously was working for Shell and Holder Topsoe and worked with oil and gas projects previously, so I understand what it takes to develop greenfields projects, right? And having this, let's say, personal motivation to bring this change, along with having this strong industrial experience, really helps in developing the supply for the green fuels.
I'm so curious to hear way more about how we can go about this and help our listeners get inspired how to make this switch to green fuels. Naomi, really lovely to have you here.
Thank you.
Rotterdam obviously plays a vital role. What is your role, and do you share that same passion as Ilyas?
Thanks. Yeah, so my personal role here is to work on sustainable transport, so very heavily linked to what Ilyas is doing. And I think looking at that sector and looking at how we achieve that, I think you can say that shipping is with right a hard to abate sector. So for my personal passion for shipping and sustainability, it is really interesting to work here because we need to do a lot still. And I think that's where you can have a lot of impact. So that's where I come from. My background is in marine engineering. So I used to work in shipbuilding, started 8 years ago. And at that time, sustainability was not very high on the agenda in any organization. I mean, you cannot say that now. It's very, in such a short period of time, a lot of change has come about, I think, in that sense. But for me, it has led to me for 1 year leaving the maritime sector to work in Uganda in a completely different sector, in the clean cooking sector. And then I was very happy to come back to the Netherlands and be able to join Port of Rotterdam, because Rotterdam is a huge energy hub, and this is where shipping and energy come together and where we need to make the change and see the difference. So, so that's where my passion comes from.
So a few things. 8 years ago, this was not high on the agenda, but we know where we're headed, right? So 2050, net zero, still a lot needs to happen. Where are we today on that sort of trajectory? Where
we are at the beginning still. A promising beginning, but unfortunately still the beginning. I think we're taking first steps, but it's really the first steps that show that things are possible. But there's a long way to go. I think, we set the target with the world. Hapag-Lloyd has a more ambitious target to be net zero by 2050. So that's still quite a few years from now. But we need to start making the change today to be able to achieve that.
What do you see happening then in terms of sustainability?
So I think if you look at Rotterdam and at the port complex, there are more than 1,000 companies active here and 30,000 ocean-going ships call our port every year. And all of these organizations have their own agenda and are working on their own things to make the changes. So if we look at the port, it's an energy and a resource transition. And you see things happening from solar panels being placed on buildings and being used to, for example, biorefineries developing in the port, enlarging in the port. But we're also looking at different energy carriers. So whereas the port now still is quite fossil based, we're looking at, for example, hydrogen derivatives. So another way of transporting energy would be through hydrogen, and ways of actually transporting hydrogen is in different molecules. But that's something that will come up, and we see developments now to put the basic infrastructure in place for that. And that's very relevant also for the maritime industry.
Yeah. Are you seeing that as well, Elias?
No, indeed. I mean, in Hapag-Lloyd, we have the strategy to be carbon net zero carbon by 2045. And we also have a 2030 target to reduce our carbon intensity in terms of EEOI.
So you can 20%. Do it 5 years faster than Rotterdam.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
But as Naomi said, the challenge is actually that we are still at the beginning stage. And in order to understand this challenge completely, we need to understand the whole supply chain of green fuels, right? Because the supply of green fuels is not there. And we need to create that supply.
Yeah. Naomi, what's happening in the energy transition? So when it really comes to that fuel switch, you just mentioned that there's multiple means of transporting the hydrogen. Like, what's happening in terms of that here?
Yeah, so I think if you look at Rotterdam as an energy hub, we've both had local production and imports already over history. And also looking at the energy transition, so going from a fossil-based to an electricity and bio-based perspective. So that's the two pathways. You can base it on electricity, or you can base it on bio feedstock. So for example, manure or other elements that we already have in nature. If we're looking at that, then we look both in Rotterdam, the production is going to change. So local production will be different, will not be fossil-based, it will be bio-based. And we also see electrolyzers that are being built in the port. So that's for the production of hydrogen, factories that will produce hydrogen. But we're also going to be importing a lot of energy. Already now, Rotterdam imports 13% of the EU energy demand. And over time, we still need to do that because we do not have enough renewable sources here in Europe for the demand that we have.
Elias, what do you see as the most suitable alternative fuel? Because there's a lot of debate, like what's it going to be? Because there's so many options right now, electric options, and then even in the biofuels, there's many different options.
I mean, at the moment, we are already consuming green fuels, right, in terms of biofuels. So we are already bunkering biofuels at Rotterdam Port. And I think overall Dutch government has introduced this HPEG subsidy system, which helped a lot the maritime sector to scale up biofuels consumption in general. general. But of course, there is a limitation of biofuels availability. And if you look at the overall numbers, right, so there is like 66 million tons of biodiesel production capacity in the world, right? Mm. And most of this biodiesel production is from first generation biofuels. And only 9 million tons of this production capacity belongs to waste and residual materials, right? Mm. So only 9 million tons of biodiesel production is there, which can process used cooking oil or animal fats as a feedstock, right?
Of that 66.
Yes. And then out of that 9 million, we have only 460,000 tons of bottoms of that product, which is FAME residue, right? Which is kind of a product which maritime sector can consume while not competing with road transport or other sectors, right? Mm. And it's a tiny quantity. And if you look at overall consumption of maritime sector, it's 320 million tons.
Oy, yeah. Okay. So there's
so
a gap.
So there's a big gap. So that's why it's challenging to scale up biofuels. One, that there is no production capacity there. And secondly, the feedstock is also not there.
Yeah.
Right? Enough amount of feedstock. But okay, what's the alternative we have is then move to bio-LNG. And then within bio-LNG, we again compete with similar feedstocks.
What is that bio-LNG?
Yeah, so bio-LNG is produced from biomethane. And biomethane is produced from organic food type of feedstock, right? And the technology which they use is called anaerobic digestion. And it's similar to our stomach, basically, that you dump all the food waste in a digester and it converts this food waste into methane.
Okay, yeah. Right. I think it's what our cows do too, right? Is that the methane gas? Yeah, all the stomachs in the world, they do that. And cows just have a lot of stomachs, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And of course, then cow manure is also a feedstock to produce methane in these digesters. Because these digesters can take any sort of organic residue as a feedstock and convert it into methane because there is a bacteria in the cow manure which then reacts with the molecules and converts it into methane. And then this methane we can purify and liquefy and then use it as a bio-LNG product.
It sounds complicated.
It is complicated, but I mean, the technology is mature, right?
Yeah.
There are already a significant amount of production of biomethane in general in Europe and overall in the world. Moving to the next step is, of course, we then see, okay, what we can scale up. And there we have methanol and ammonia.
Mm-hmm.
These are the fuels which we can in future scale up.
Yeah. So the global container shipping sector, of course, is a huge sector. We know we need to scale up to actually make sure that the sector has enough. So I assume it's a huge challenge to change that. And in my eyes, but I might be wrong, but it's a bit of a conservative industry. And if things work the way they do, and even though we're creating a problem somewhere between two rivers in Pakistan, we might not be feeling it yet. So the sense of urgency, you know, we're getting there, but it's slow. What is needed? What can enable this fuel switch? What might trigger this sector?
Yeah. Well, I think from our perspective, we look at it through the three A's, so to say. So we say it needs to be allowed, it needs to be available, and it needs to be affordable.
Mm.
And if you're talking about a trigger, it may actually be in the allowed part. So regulations that motivate obligate people to start moving, while there may not be, you know, in the end, a business case yet, because that comes back to the affordable. So if we look at available, affordable, allowed, there's a role to play for us as a port authority to make sure that at least it's possible to bunker those fuels in the port so that the regulations are in place and the procedures are in place to safely be able to bunker those fuels.
Mm.
And also together with the entire ecosystem in the port to make sure that the infrastructure is there. So for example, bunker barges. Now, if we look at that's not easy, but we can manage that. We can oversee how we achieve that. But if we look at the major challenge, and it comes back a bit to what Ilyas was just saying, is that connection between availability and affordability. And we always coin that as the chicken egg issue in maritime. So, well, the chicken egg, we know they're there. We don't know which one was first. So that's fun to talk about. But if we're talking about fuels, then the question is, which one will come first? Will the demand come first or will the supply come first?
Mm-hmm. And do you have examples of companies that are sort of wanting to make that step but are sort of waiting for both those conditions? Or what then? Because if you talk about these three A's, available, affordable, allowed, those are conditions you need to meet. But is that going to be the trigger to actually do it once it's possible? If the alternative is also available, affordable, and very allowed and very easy.
I think there is enough societal pressure and also, I think, intrinsic motivation with a lot of people to make the difference. But of course, if we look at the original definition of sustainability, in the end, it needs to be profitable as well. Otherwise, your company will not be able to survive your changes. So that's not a long-term perspective. So I think, yes, if those conditions are met and things are moving to meet those conditions, and I think it's interesting to also hear Ilja's perspective because you're trying to do this as an organization. But then I really think it is possible. And yeah, we're also looking at finding new levers to achieve this sooner rather than later, so to accelerate this.
Yeah. So what actions is Hapag-Lloyd taking to accelerate the transition? Is it just meeting those three A's and then go with it? Or what kind of resistance do you still encounter?
The way we are working on it is that we are working across the globe with different project developers who are trying to create the supply of the green fuels, and then supporting them with the offtake commitments, which can then help them to raise the project finance and then make those projects happen, right, and create the supply. But what we see, the challenge is that the future green fuels such as ammonia and methanol, the cost base for those fuels is very high, and much higher than as compared to what we see now for the fossil fuels, even if we include EUA taxes into that equation, it still doesn't help.
That doesn't help with the affordability.
No, not. And also, like, we have another legislation in Europe, it's called Fuel EU Maritime. It's also the ambition level until 2035 is not that high. So it does not create significant demand for green fuels. So we see that that there is, let's say, from the regulatory side, there is no big pressure to create or to develop these projects and create to make the commitments based on these obligations which these regulatory bodies could potentially introduce,
right?
Which are not there.
What do you think about this?
I completely agree that regulators are the ones that can really help, you know, get things moving. Preferably, yes, ambitions of regulators are higher. I do think that we can also be positive that at least regulations are being implemented now, because this is the first year, 2024, that maritime is actually part of such regulations. And the EU is just big enough to be able to do that, because preferably, indeed, you would do it on a global scale and you would have a completely level playing field across the globe. So that's why we're also looking at the International Maritime Organization that can set such ambitions, rules, regulations for the entire globe. So I agree, we would love to see everything slightly more ambitious. On the other hand, I think we should also be very positive that there is a package that will move this. I think the major challenge that maritime faces, different from other maybe transport sectors, is that there is no single solution. So we cannot say it will be, for example, let's say methanol. There will be a range of fuels. And as a port, we're preparing for all these different fuels. But having a mandate in place does not tell the fuel supplier yet which fuel they need to produce, because there's still a range of fuels they could be looking at. So that's the challenge still in that chicken egg situation, that we don't yet know what to bet on. And I think if we can find a way to overcome that, that's really, really helpful. And I think also Hapag-Lloyd is much further ahead than many other ship owner operators, of course. So that's also where there's still a difference in the market, because shipping used to be buying bottom of the barrel fuels on the spot market. And now we're looking at long-term contracts, because investments in production facilities take years. It's not something we will do in in a year or weeks and take billions. So that's also a big challenge.
You make huge investments and a lot of people are a bit wary, like, are we really going to dive into these green fuels? But Hapag-Lloyd is already doing it. So can you really break this down for us? What does that mean?
So all Hapag-Lloyd owned vessels, they can run on biofuels. So we have already upgraded whatever upgrades were needed to run them on the biofuels.
Does that require change within the ship or the engine, or how do you do that?
So with the drop in biofuels, we don't need significant changes, right? But if we switch from fossil fuels to LNG, then of course it requires a retrofit, and we did it previously. We retrofitted one vessel from fossil fuels to dual fuel LNG, which we now we're gonna run at bio LNG. But of course with the methanol, it's a very different engine because the methanol energy density is half the energy density of fuel oil, so you need double the size of the storage tanks on your ships. So and ammonia is also a whole new game, right? It's refrigerated liquid with toxicity and safety issues. So there are a lot of changes needed, but I think or the fuel which can save shipping sector will be the fuel like biomass pyrolysis based drop in biofuels.
Okay.
And there is right now those fuels are not stable enough to be used as a fuel in the shipping sector.
There's an issue with availability, or can we scale that up?
Yes, we can scale that up. There is a lot of feedstock available. The issue is with the technology.
Yeah.
For the maritime sector, these drop in biofuels made from biomass pyrolysis are very attractive because then these fuels cannot be used in other sectors such as road transport or aviation because they are dirty enough to be consumed by the maritime sector but not by the other like four-stroke engines or jet engines.
Yeah.
And like Naomi was mentioning, I mean, historically, maritime sector has been using bottom of the barrel, right? The residual material from the crude distillation unit in the oil refinery.
Because ships aren't picky, they can run on anything.
So the engines are big. So they're two-stroke big engines and they can consume relatively dirtier fuel as compared to the four-stroke engines in cars or trucks.
Yeah. So the drop in biofuel, that's what you're betting on. What do you think? What's going to be the winner?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question from our perspective. We are not the ones in the end who need to run the ships on these fuels or need to produce the fuels. We need to provide the platform and the ecosystem where this can happen. So we're actually fuel agnostic in our approach that we're trying to facilitate all the fuels at the relevant timeline. So if EOS is coming to me and saying, well, next week I would love to, then probably that's too soon. But if, for example, ammonia is not yet mature yet, so methanol has been bunkered in Rotterdam, also green methanol has been bunkered here. For example, ammonia is a fuel that has a lot of interest in the maritime sector, but the engines are not available yet. Mm-hmm. So technically you cannot sail on ammonia yet, but they will come hopefully this year. So as a port, we keep those timelines in sight and then say we cannot be a bottleneck for this. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're working on. So it's a very boring answer, but we're not betting on any fuel. We're trying to
facilitate to anything
facilitate
and everything.
Everything. And we're as Rotterdam, we're the second largest bunker hub globally. So we have the luxury, I think, to be able to facilitate this also because we have lots of storage capacity, et cetera, et cetera.
Because at the same time, you're also still providing fossil fuels for the companies that need and want that still.
Yeah, the port ecosystem still does that, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's the right strategy, right? But in the end, we need to see, okay, on the supply curve of the green fuels, which the fuels which will be enabled first will be the ones which are most cost competitive.
Yeah.
And then when we will mature the supply of those fuels, then the next marginal fuel will come, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment it's biofuels, and as the regulatory demands pick up and voluntary demands pick up for the green fuels,
right,
then we will exhaust the supply of the biofuels, drop in biofuels, and then of course methanol will come into the picture. I think before that, bio-LNG will come into the picture because at the moment we can defossilize our LNG vessels easily with the bio-LNG.
Yeah.
And methanol production capacity is not even there, right?
Yeah.
So the only methanol which can be produced is by using biomethane, which actually you can directly use as a fuel, right? And that just is also ironical because biomethane has, let's say, more than double the energy density of methanol. So you need less amount of fuel as a bio-LNG as compared to methanol.
Yeah, because the idea of having more space occupy your ship to just carry your fuel doesn't seem like a very attractive thing when you are a cargo shipper.
Yes, yes, yes.
Right? Yeah.
And then, of course, but if we look in the long term, let's say for in the end game, then comparing methane versus versus methanol, then methanol has its advantages.
Mm-hmm.
But in the short and medium term, I think bio-LNG is more preferable green fuel.
If I get you right, it's like it's all about pushing it forward. Just keep pushing it forward. What's available now is available now. We're going to work with that. But the technology is going to continue to develop.
But I think that will only happen if we find a way to address the cost gap. And it is maybe important to note that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Iras, but about 70 to 90% of the operational costs of a ship operator are in the fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an insane premium if the fuel is, for example, twice as expensive.
Yeah.
So either fossil should become less cheap, or we should reduce the price of the renewable fuels. And that comes with scale. So we need some intermediate scaling mechanisms that will help us to make it more attractive.
Yeah, and then you point to regulations, obviously, because if fossil still is cheap, then of course that's going to be a very attractive alternative.
We need to tax fossils, right, on the CO2 emissions. And more that tax becomes higher, the more viable becomes the business case for green fuels.
Because then there's an incentive, of course.
Yes.
You really make a big point that transparency in decarbonization is very important. Well, you're giving a lot of insight into your business, so that's great. Why is that so vital?
Because we are doing decarbonization for the betterment of the world, right? Betterment of the planet and overall the business is business. We sell our containers to our customers. And the way we are commercializing sustainability is through our ShipGreen product, which customers can purchase and transport their goods based on biofuels consumed for the transportation of those containers. And the way we do it is on a fully transparent basis.
Mm-hmm.
So the customers, they can see the index which we use. It's publicly available index for biofuels, and they can see, how much has been the improvements or decrease in index. So based on the changes in the index of the biofuels, the price, we adjust the premium on the ShipGreen.
Mm-hmm.
And that is fully transparent. And we believe if we don't do this, if we don't create this transparency, then customers will feel that, because they are paying also on voluntary basis, right?
Yeah.
There is no regulatory push or penalty for them to do not to do it. But of course, they have a brand value and soft recognition. But still, I think we as a company, we need to keep it fully transparent that the premium we charge on ShipGreen is seeable and it's not overly charged. And same, actually, we expect from our fuel green fuel suppliers,
mm-hmm,
that they have to be also open and transparent.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they start adding fat on the production costs, then the green fuels will become even more and more expensive and nobody will be able to consume them.
Yeah.
And like, for example, in the fossil market is more or less mature, right? I mean, in different countries, there is a different level of cost of production of crude oil. And then, of course, the marginal producer is setting the price, right, in the overall market. But the green fuels market is evolving. So there is no, there is no clarity what is the production cost of one fuel versus another fuel.
Mm.
So, and depending on the project's locations and availability of the feedstocks and the incentives by the governments, the production cost can vary from region to region. So therefore, it's important that we create transparency on the fuel side, and also we should give the same transparency to our customers, so that everybody can trust that this is new evolving system, but nobody is taking any unfair advantage of it.
Yeah. I think maybe with any new system, trust is very important, because we're still building it very much. So if I am a cargo owner and I'm seeking out opportunities to make this switch, is the Port of Rotterdam here to sort of help me decide, or to help me understand what the options are? What role can you play?
Yeah, I think what we're here for is to say that it's indeed important to consider your transport as something you can influence, so the sustainability of your transport. And we call that insetting. So you can compensate for your emissions by offsetting. I think maybe we also do that personally sometimes. You can, for example, say planting trees somewhere, which is not bad. But if you do insetting, you do something similar. It's somehow disconnected from your actual transport, so the actual movement of your container. But you're paying for a share of renewable fuel that is an equivalent of the transport of that container.
And so in that way, you compensate in some way.
Yeah, well, and you could even say reduce maybe, because you're actually making a difference in your own value chain. And by that, you help, reduce the cost gap and help the sector overcome that chicken egg issue. So you're helping development and innovation in the sector to really come to that scale. So that's how we view it. And that's what we want to support. If you are a cargo owner and you're already willing, then you're a front runner, because we see that there's a lot of cargo owners that maybe want to do something, but they're not very sure. And also the price tag is still pretty significant. So of course, that's also a consideration. So we are trying to spread the word that it's possible, that it's important to do. And we're also setting up small projects around this. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we had a Switch to Zero campaign together with a fuel supplier here in the port, where they provided this service of insetting to those cargo owners. And together with those cargo owners, we reduced almost 2,000 tons of CO2, let me not exaggerate, which is limited, but it's a first step. Yeah. And that's what it starts with. Mm-hmm. So the Ship Green program does exactly the same. So we're not going to say which one is better. I think transparency and the transparency the Green Ship program provides is very impressive and very important. We're here to show that it's possible. Yeah.
Ilias, as a front runner, maybe you can give some advice to someone who's looking to make this change. Where to start?
So the advice would be for the policymakers that they should look at the overall supply chain, mm-hmm. right? Starting from the fuel production and the investment in the fuel production, and then ending with the consumption of those green containers, mm-hmm. right? So, and then there are a lot of different companies involved in this whole supply chain. And the policies should be made in a way which can incentivize or penalize for the parties who are either emitting the fossil CO2 emissions it should incentivize for those companies who are consuming green fuels in a way that we create a, let's say, cost competitive environment for the companies who want to decarbonize, who have the ambitious agenda, so that they are not outcompeted in the business, but they can still remain in the business in a healthy environment financially while also doing the decarbonization.
Absolutely. That's in terms of policy, but you have done it as a company, even with the policies that are in place right now. So it is possible.
Yeah, it is possible. And I would say it's thanks to our customers, right? Those front runner cargo owners who are buying Ship Green from Hapag-Lloyd, mm-hmm. and they are actually contributing into the decarbonization of the shipping sector. We as a shipping company, of course, we need to expedite our efforts in creating the supply for the green fuels and motivating the project developers to develop this supply on the most cost-effective basis, so that our cargo owners, who are our customers, they see the lowest CO2 abatement cost. Mm-hmm. Because at the moment, they are paying high CO2 abatement cost. And our intention is that we should lower it as much as possible and bring it to zero in the end, so that nobody should pay then extra, because then overall system should be evolved at a level where we are competitive, in terms of green fuels, that we achieve the decarbonization without having any cost impact on anybody, right?
Absolutely.
And that would be the ideal goal, right?
Yes, definitely. Yes. Well, there's a lot to do until 2045 or 2050 or whenever we can make it happen before that, but that might be tough. We're setting high goals for ourselves, at least you are. So thank you for sharing a little bit on how you go about that, what the different options are, and trying to really give some hands-on examples for people that are listening and share this ambition with you. The supply chain of the future, of course, is sustainable and an efficient supply chain. And the future is now. It needs to be happening now. Thank you so much, Ilias, Naomi, for joining me today and shedding light on how you're both working towards the supply chain of the future. In the next episode of Supply Chain Talks, I will be joined by IKEA.
For us in IKEA, first of all, we do not believe that sustainability should come at a premium, that you need to pay more for sustainable products. I mean, sustainable products should really be the better option, the option that you choose for the benefit of the environment and the customer.
If you want to know more, check out portofrotterdam.com/container shipping. Thank you again for joining us. Feel free to share this podcast with others that might be interested in the topic, and please tune in again. Thanks for listening.